This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Becoming the Archangel Michael's Companions, Rudolf Steiner's Challenge to the Younger Generation. This is Lecture 7, given in Stuttgart on October 9th, 1922. Yesterday I pointed out how the longing that can permeate the young today must have something like a Janus head. At first, this appears to be permeated by enthusiasm that comes from opposition. But however strongly, at the beginning of the 20th century, this feeling breathed the present, we can say already today that whoever has a sense for the yearning characterized no longer finds the opposition in its full measure. Many do not yet admit this impartially, particularly among the young themselves. Yet it indicates something very significant. The generation which at the beginning of the 20th century confronted world evolution in such a way that, quote, facing nothingness, close quote, was a most profound experience, was actually something quite new in human evolution. Today the situation is such that this feeling must reckon with many disappointments prepared out of its own depths. The full spread of the sails, as it was some 20 years ago, is no longer there. Not only the terrible event of the World War has deflated these sails, World War I, but certain experiences, working outward from within, have arisen in young people and modified their original feeling. One such experience became evident at the beginning of the 20th century in the feelings of those who had grown older in years but were not inwardly old. It was not clearly expressed in words, but in other than the literal words, there was, in the young, something that pointed to a responsive tiredness. I am placing a concept before you here that wants to describe something that is difficult to describe precisely. It is difficult because what I really mean is only fully intelligible to those who have experienced the youth movement with a certain wakefulness, whereas a great part of humanity has been asleep to this youth movement. When one speaks to people in the way I have during the past days, it is as if one were talking of something quite foreign to them, something they have slept through, and toward which even today they act in an extraordinarily sleepy manner. Responsive tiredness, I call it. In ordinary life, organic existence requires not only activity, but also the accompanying state of tiredness after the accomplished work. We must not only be able to get tired, we must also from time to time be able to carry tiredness around within us. To pass our days in such a way that we go to sleep at night simply because it is customary to do so is not healthy. It is certainly less healthy than to have the due amount of tiredness in the evening and for this to lead in the normal way into sleep. So too, the capacity to become tired out by the phenomena meeting us in life is something that must be. When education, for example, has been discussed, I have often heard it said that there must be a pedagogy that makes learning into a game for children. School must be all joy for the child. Yes, those who speak like this should just try making school all joy for children, so that the children laugh all the time, so that learning is play, and at the same time they are learning something. This is the very best possible educational principle for ensuring that nothing at all is learned. The right thing is for teachers to be able to handle what does not give the child joy, but perhaps a good deal of toil and woe, in such a way that the child, as a matter of course, submits to it. It is very easy to say what should be taught to the child. But childhood can be ruined by learning being made into a game. For it is essential that we should also be made tired in our soul by certain things, that they should cause toil and exertion. One must express it thus, even if it sounds pedantic. Tiredness existed among the young, in earlier times too, when they had to strive toward something living, a certain knowledge, a certain kind of insight. I mean times when those possessing a certain amount of knowledge were still able to stand before the young who wanted to acquire it as an embodied ideal. Tiredness certainly existed even then. My dear friends, there may be some here who take the above statement with mild skepticism. There are many people today who would take it with skepticism, for when it is claimed that those who knew something stood as a kind of ideal for those anxious to learn, this idea appears to many as unrealizable. For at the present time, it is almost incredible that anybody should be regarded as a kind of embodied insight or knowledge, which we strive for like a personal ideal. Yet, disregarding ancient times, this feeling was still present to a high degree even in the later Middle Ages. Those wonderful and inspiring feelings of reverence, permeating life with real recreative forces for the soul still in the later Middle Ages, have to a great extent been lost. And because the yearning that once fired people up for science was no longer there, the young could no longer get tired from their studies. To give this concrete expression, I should have to say, science became something that did not live in human heads, but was stored in the libraries. Science gradually became something that was not really wanted anymore. Hence, one did not tire from it anymore. Because one did not feel oneself pervaded by the yearning for it, it no longer made one tired. There was no possibility of getting tired from the knowledge that was to be achieved. And from this, what permeated the young at the turn of the 19th and the 20th century derived a quite special character, the character of the life force in human beings, who go to bed at night, who are not tired and keep turning and twisting about without knowing why. I do not want to imply anything derogatory, for I am not of the opinion that these forces, which are there at night in human beings when they turn and twist about in bed, because they are not tired, are unhealthy forces. I am not calling them unhealthy. They are quite healthy life forces, but they are not in their proper place. And so it was, in a certain sense, with those forces that worked in the young at the turn of the 19th century. They were thoroughly healthy forces, but there was nothing to give them direction. The young had no longer the desire to apply these forces to what was told them by their elders. Yet forces cannot be present in the world without being active, and so, at the time referred to, innumerable forces yearned for activity and had no guiding line. These forces appeared, for example, in the young students. Since the first third of the 15th century, all human striving for knowledge out of intellectuality has taken on a quite particular character. Human beings are supposed to devote themselves to something that one called science, but which hardly touches or has anything to do with the human being at all. People can no longer feel what humanity holds. Maybe that again. People can no longer feel what humanity holds sway in writings of the 12th and 13th century. This does not imply that we have to return to the 12th or 13th century, to implicit belief in all we find there. We certainly do not want to comply with the demands of certain churches in this direction. It is not possible to go deeply into what, for instance, Albertus Magnus wrote with the same indifference with which people today study biology or some other work. In that way, we cannot get to know what he wrote at all. We must take the book and sit down with it as if we were sitting down in front of another human being, with whom we do not take what he or she says with indifference, or objectively, as one says, but with whom the inner being of our soul is engaged. It rises and falls, and is quickened to movement. The soul is at work when we read even the driest chapter written at that time, by an Albertus Magnus, for instance. Quite apart from the fact that in these writings there is still the power of pictorial expression for what appear abstract things, there is always something in the general ideas that gives us a feeling of movement, as if we might be working with spade and shovel, I mean in the soul. Quite aside from this splendid human activity, through the pictures, care is taken that those who possess this knowledge have full confidence in what they are imparting. For such people, it was not a matter of indifference whether they felt that what they discovered in their seeking pleased God or not. To those who realize the difference between the picture that an Albertus Magnus gives, as the great scholar of the Middle Ages, and that of one of the eminent minds of the 19th century, for example, Herbart, one could name others, but Herbart had a great influence on education up into the last third of the 19th century. Albertus Magnus appears like a fiery, luminous cloud. When Albertus Magnus devotes himself to knowledge, something that lights up in him or becomes dim, we feel him as it were in a fiery, luminous cloud. And if we are gradually able to enter into such a soul, we come into this fire ourselves. Even if for the modern soul it is antiquated, we feel that it is not a matter of indifference when we steep ourselves in what is moral, write it down, speak about it, or even just study it, whether or not one is sympathetic or antipathetic toward a divine spiritual being. This feeling of sympathy or antipathy always plays a part. On the other hand, if we steep ourselves in the way Herbart objectively and scientifically discusses the five moral ideas, goodwill, perfection, benevolence, rights, and retribution, we do not have a cloud that encircles us with warmth or cold, but something that gradually freezes us. It is objective to the point of iciness. And that is the mood that has crept into the whole nature of knowledge and reached its climax at the end of the 19th century. And so knowledge gradually became something to which people devoted themselves in a way that even outwardly was quite remarkable. It was only at the lecture podium that one got to know those represented as men of knowledge. I do not know if others as old as I am have had similar experiences, but in the 1890s I had cause for annoyance again and again. At that time I had been mixing in all kinds of learned circles. I often needed to enjoy such society and was eager to discuss this or that question. I looked forward to speak once again about the difference between epigenesis and evolution, for instance. However, when one began with this, one soon heard, "No, there is to be no shop talk." Anything that savored of talking shop was taboo. The knowledgeable were only experienced at the lecture podium. When they left it, they were no longer the same as they had been. They became someone else. They spoke about everything under the sun, except their own special subject. In short, life and science became so objective that those with a special subject treated this too very objectively and wanted to be ordinary people when not obliged to deal with their subject. One can connect still other feelings with this. I have said this only for the sake of elucidation, but I will tell you the real point in another way. Teachers can bring what they have only half learned in this way or that to the young. We find, for example, those who teach standing before their classes with notebooks, or even books written by someone else. For all I know, their notebooks too may contain things written by other people, but I will not assume that. And boldly setting to work to give their lessons out of these books. By such a procedure, they are presupposing that there is no supersensible world at all. How is it that one says that those who give their lessons from a notebook or some other book are presupposing that no supersensible world exists? Here, too, Nietzsche had one of his many interesting flashes of insight. He called attention to the fact that within every human being another is hidden. This is taken to be a poetic way of speaking, but it is no such thing. In every human being another is hidden. This hidden being is often much more intelligent than the one who is visible. In the child, for example, this hidden being is infinitely wiser. This being is a supersensible reality and is within the human being. And if teachers sit in front of a class of, say, 30 pupils and teach with the help of a book or a notebook, they may perhaps be able to train these 30 pupils to regard this in their visible selves as something natural. But of this we can be quite certain. All of the 30 invisible human beings sitting there are judging differently. They say of those teachers, quote, "They are wanting to teach me something that they first have to read. I should like to know why I am expected to know what they are reading. There is no reason for me to know what they are only now reading for themselves. They do not know it themselves. Otherwise they would not need to stand there with the book in hand. I am still very young and am expected to learn what they who are so much older do not know even yet and read to me out of a book." Close quote. These things must be taken concretely. To speak of a supersensible world does not mean merely to lose oneself in fantastic mysticism and to talk of things that are, I say this with quotation marks, hidden from one. To speak of supersensible worlds means, with regard to life, to speak about actual realities. We are speaking of actual realities when we speak, as the 30 invisible children spoke about the teacher of the 30 visible ones, who, perhaps only out of obedience, were too timid to say this aloud. If we think it through, it does not seem so stupid. The statements of these 30 invisible, supersensible beings are, in fact, quite reasonable. Thus we must realize that in the young individuality, sitting before the teacher or educator, much goes on that is entirely hidden from outer perception. And that was how there arose deep aversion to what came in this way. For naturally students could not have a great deal of confidence in a teacher who faced their hidden being out of the objective, scientific approach generally common at the end of the 19th century. So a deep antipathy was felt. One simply did not try to take up what should have carried one through life, and consequently could not get tired from it. There was no longer the desire to have what would have made one tired. And nobody knew what to do with the forces that could have led to the tiredness. Now one could also meet such people, like those who were in the youth movement at the turn of the 19th century, elsewhere. Often, they were not young physically, but rather very old. They could be met in movements like the Theosophical movement. There were many in that movement who were no longer young, yet had a feeling toward what contemporary knowledge gave them that was similar to the young. They did not want this knowledge, because it could no longer make them tired. Whereas the young, as the result of this incapacity to get tired, raged, forgive the expression, many theosophists were looking in their theosophy for a kind of sleeping potion or opiate. For what is contained in theosophical literature is to a great extent a sleeping potion for the soul. People were actually lulling themselves to sleep. They kept the spirit busy, but look at the way in which they did so, by inventing the maddest allegories. It was enough to drive a sensitive soul out of its body to listen to the explanations given to old myths and sagas. What allegories and symbols were thought up? Looked at from the biology of the life of soul, it was all sleeping potion. It would really be quite good to draw a parallel between the turning and twisting in bed after spending a day that has not been tiring, and the taking of a sleeping draught in order to cripple the real activity of the spirit. What I describe are not theories, but moods of the age. And it is imperative to become familiar with these moods by looking from every angle at what was there. This incapacity to get tired at the turn of the 19th century is extraordinarily significant. Yes, but this led to the impossibility of finding anything right, for human evolution had arrived at a point where people said with great enthusiasm, "We shall allow nothing to come to us from outside. We want to develop everything from within our own being. We want to wander through the world and wait until there comes out of our own inner being what neither parents nor teachers nor even the old traditions can give us any longer. We want to wait for the new to approach us." My dear friends, ask those who have spoken in such a way, whether this new thing has come to them, whether it has dropped ready-made into the laps of those who have had this great longing. Indeed, the intoxication of those times is beginning in some degree to be followed by the morning-after headache. My only aim, however, is to characterize, not to criticize. The first thing that arose was a great rejection, a rejection of something that was there, which human beings could not use for their innermost being. And behind this great rejection there was hidden the positive, the genuine longing for something new. This genuine longing for what is new can be fulfilled in no other way than by human beings permeating themselves with something not of this earth. When people only let soul and body function as they do, nothing can come that really has the power to satisfy. The human being who is unwilling to take in anything is like a lung that finds no air to breathe. Certainly a lung that finds no air to breathe may first, before it dies, even if only for a moment, experience the greatest thirst for air. But the lung cannot out of itself quench this thirst for air. It has to allow for the air to come to it. In reality, the young who honestly feel the thirst of which we have been speaking cannot help but long for something with which to be in harmony. That does not come only out of the self, like the science that has grown old and is no longer a wholesome air for the soul to breathe. That was felt in the first place. But far too little, that a new young science must be there, a new spiritual life that is able once again to unite with the soul. Now, what belongs to present and future ages must link itself with older phenomena of human evolution. The difference is that these old phenomena of human evolution arose from a life of soul that was full of pictures and dreamlike, whereas the life of soul we bear within us, and toward which we are still striving, must become fully conscious. But we must, in many respects, go back to older contents of the soul. Now I should like to turn your mind's eye to a disposition of the spirit prevailing in old Brahmanism in the ancient East. The old Brahman school spoke of four means of knowledge on the path of life. It is difficult to give ancient thoughts in a suitable form, because we are living not only centuries but thousands of years later. However, in order to get somewhere near the mark, I will depict these four means to knowledge. The first means was what hovered, as it were, midway between tradition and remembrance, something connected with the Sanskrit root smrti, of which today one has only an idea. Yet it can be characterized. Everyone knows what remembrance, personal memory, is. These people did not connect the idea I have here in mind with personal remembrance as closely as we connect certain concepts with memory today. It was much more so that what they remembered out of their own childhood flowed together and became one with what was passed on to them by others. They did not distinguish between what they themselves remembered and what they received through tradition. If you were to practice a more subtle psychology, you would notice that actually these things flow together in the soul of the child, because the child takes in a great deal that is based on tradition. Modern human beings see only that they acquired these things in childhood. Ancient Indians did not see this. They paid much more heed to its content, which did not lead them into their own childhood, but to their parent, grandparent, and great-grandparent. Thus, tradition and personal remembrance flowed into each other indistinguishably. That was the first means of acquiring knowledge. The second means for acquiring knowledge was what we might describe as being introduced, parenthesis, not an introduction in the sense of conventional social interactions today, in which one says the name, but literally, and quote, appearing before the eyes, close quote, close parenthesis, what we might call perception today. The third means to knowledge was what we might call thinking that synthesizes. Thus we could also say remembrance with tradition, observation, and the thinking that synthesizes. A fourth means for acquiring knowledge was also taught with all clarity in ancient Brahmanism. This can be described as having something communicated by other human beings. So I ask you to notice that in ancient Brahmanism, tradition was not identified with having something communicated by other human beings. This was a fourth means for the attainment of knowledge. Perhaps this will be clearer if we link it up with what it is tradition, and at the same time, what the nature of remembrance is. Where tradition is concerned, human beings did not become conscious of the way in which it came to them. They were conscious only of the content. However, with the fourth means to knowledge, the way and manner in which it came to one was the important thing. In human remembrance, a person had in mind that it had been communicated to him by someone else. The fact of having received something from others was an awakening force in knowledge itself. I think that today many of those who are true children of the 19th century would shake their heads if we counted this what is told us by others as one of the means of acquiring knowledge. Philosophers who dabble in thinking that synthesizes and regard what they are told by others as a means of knowledge will never succeed with their thesis, nor be accepted as university lecturers. At most, they might succeed in joining a theological faculty, for theology is judged in a different way. What is at the bottom of all this? In olden times, people understood the experience of having something kindled within them in mutual interaction with another human being. They counted somebody else's telling them what they themselves did not know as among the things they needed in order to be able to live. It was reckoned so emphatically as one of the factors necessary for life that it was considered equal to perception through the eyes and the ears. More often today, people will naturally have a different feeling, that it is splendid for human beings to tell another what the other does not know, and the world calls for this. But it has nothing to do with the essence of things. What is essential is for observations and experiments to be made and for the results to be clearly expressed. The other has nothing to do with the essential nature of knowledge. It is natural to feel this today, but from the human standpoint it is not correct. It is part of life that humans should be permeated in soul and spirit by what I described yesterday as a necessary vehicle of the social life, namely by confidence. In this particular domain, confidence consists of what one human being tells another, thus becoming for the other a source of soul spiritual experience. Confidence must above all things be evoked in the young. That for which the young are thirsting must be found out of confidence. Our whole modern spiritual development has moved in the opposite direction. Even in theoretical pedagogy, no value is attached any longer to the fact that a human being might have something he or she would like to tell another which the latter did not know. Theoretical pedagogy was thought out in such a way that, as far as possible, there was presented to the young only what could be proved in front of them. But that could not be a comprehensive proof. In this regard, people have therefore remained at a very infantile stage. Pedagogy thought, to a certain extent, how can I give the children something, even under the assumption that they do not believe me? How can I introduce a method which proves perceptibly? No wonder there came the corresponding echo, and it was henceforth demanded of teachers, yes, now prove that to me. And now what I am going to say may sound antiquated, my dear friends, but I do not feel it to be old, but really quite young, even as part of the youth movement. Today, when someone stands there before a number of young people who are to be taught, it is as if there sounds out of the young souls, even before this teacher has approached them, prove that to me. You have no right to ask us to believe you. I feel it as tragic, and this is no criticism, that the young should suffer from having been educated by the old in such a way that they no longer have the ability to receive what is necessary for life. And so there arises a tremendous question, which we shall be considering in the next few days. I should like to give you a somewhat radical description of it. Let us imagine the youth movement progressing and taking hold of younger and younger human beings and finally mere infants. We would then get an infant youth movement, and just as the later youth movement rejects the knowledge that can be given to it, so will the infants who ought still to be at their mother's breasts say, "We refuse it. We refuse to receive anything from outside. We don't want our mother's milk any longer. We want to get everything out of ourselves." What I have here presented as a picture is a burning question for the youth movement. For the young are really asking, where are we to obtain spiritual nourishment? And the way in which they have asked hitherto has been very suggestive of this picture of the infants. And so in the coming days we shall consider the question of the source of life, in quotes, after which Faust was striving. The question I have put before you as a picture is intended to stimulate us to contribute toward a solution, but a solution which may mean something for your perception, for your feeling, even for your whole life. The end of Lecture 7.